This week on Retronauts, my spirit does not taste like cherry pop, Dracula. Welcome, Belmont, and welcome to this week's episode of Retronauts. I am your host, Nadia Oxford. I also double as the co-host of the Acts of the Blood God podcast. In the 80s, it was, you know, kind of hard to convince your parents that NES games were anything but digital trash that rotted your brain the way that cotton floss kind of rots your teeth. The NES, I'll just say in my house, it was like the first thing to go on the high shelf when you're great, when you're on the high shelf of your parents' closet when your grades started to slip. Books, however, books were kind of slower to be banned. Like, books were never out of reach in my house. It was even at the point where it was like, mom, can I read this completely out of age Stephen King book? Oh, sure, sweetie, that's fine. Mom, can I watch this R-rated movie? No. So, you know, the kind of household, and that was very much my household. So what if some enterprising publisher were to write and sell Nintendo-based adventures in book form? Ho, 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 delightfully devilish, Seth Godin. I am referring to the Worlds of Power series of books that narrated Nintendo games via text. They were written specifically to engage young non-readers, especially boys. But, you know, how did they fare? How effective was a video game adventure where a, you know, gun-toting character like Solid Snake isn't allowed to fire a single bullet? So, you know, let's talk about it. And in fact, here to help me talk about it is the deliciously named Gary Butterfield, the writer and podcaster and director from Duckfeed TV, and also the author of a couple of modern takes on World of Power. And we will certainly get to that. But first, please, Gary, thank you for joining me and say hi.
Oh, hello. Hi, Nadja. Thank you for having me.
Oh, very, very welcome.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Yeah, I am a podcaster primarily, but also do music, and I've written a couple books with the Duckfeed.tv network. Yep, live in Portland, Oregon. Tall, very brown hair, big. You know, I look like a Portlander. Beard, glasses. That's a little bit of
myself.
Oh,
there you go. You got the costume. What kind of music do you write?
Oh, I like silly pop music, kind of like prog pop. I think they might be giant-y kind of.
Yeah.
Like time signature pop stuff sometimes.
So it's no wonder you're friends with Jeremy Parrish.
I haven't had a chance to corner Jeremy about prog. It's a different kind of prog, but I love that about him. I love when that comes up. And I love it specifically when it sneaks into non-prog things. Like, you'll be watching NES Works and there'll just be an offhanded mention of, like, you know, like Young Marble Giants or something.
Oh, yeah, he does that. Yeah, for sure. He's the king of Prague, the king crimson of Prague, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
This we both know. So what is your history with Worlds of Power? Like, of course, these were books that were published in the 80s, so I'm guessing you're an old person like myself, unless maybe you discovered them later in life, which I suppose is completely, you know.
Kids possible. Are getting into World of Power books now. They're calling it power booking. Your kids are doing
they're grinding them up and snorting it. Ooh, I feel like someone isekai'd into a new book.
I'm going to isekai the snorty into my nose. It's going to go on a fun adventure in my lungs and then my bloodstream.
Going on a fun adventure in the hospital.
I was born in 1980, so I was like right in the pocket. And I imagine this is a really common story with these. It was the closest, you know, I love Nintendo, played Nintendo every second that I could. My mom used to say, made up Nintendo fever, like, oh, you're going to get Nintendo fever to stop me from playing for long periods of time. Right. And I had that child's lack of discernment. So I'd just be saying they're like begging to play Trojan for, you know,
Trojan
an extra
was the best. I would
20
play,
minutes.
I'd beg for Trojan.
Yeah. You know, like, just it was I really wanted it. So when I was at school, I wanted to you know, still engage with that. And for me, we had the bookmobile.
We had a bookmobile. Yep.
And just seeing the thing that got me into these was seeing the Mega Man 2. Mega Man 2 was the first. I got an NES a little bit late, so that was the first NES game I got. Cool. And the seeing that cover. You know, I was a little bit older than that. That's the junior series. But I saw the same cover. So I was like, oh, there's a Mega Man book. That's nuts. And then just spent every time there was a bookmobile that would come around, I would hunt for these. Just felt like playing Nintendo at school. It was the weird way when you're a kid, you didn't understand how, or at least for me, I couldn't understand how things came out. Yeah, like the idea of there being a publisher and like schedules. So it just felt like randomly, it felt like opening a treasure chest and there might be a new world of Power book I could get, you know, when the bookmobile came around.
The magical bookmobile. Yeah. My first apartment growing up, we weren't really close to a library, so we had the bookmobile come around, but I did not get into Worlds of Power from the bookmobile. In fact, I actually didn't get into it until my husband, we met and he came to Canada and he brought his Worlds of Power books, I suppose, like a dowry of some kind. And so I read them, a hell of a dowry. Yeah. But I read them there once I had them. But before that, when I was a kid, I was really into the, you know, I can't remember the exact name, Super Mario Choose Your Own Adventure, Nintendo System books, I think they were called. Yeah, those weren't too bad. Well, a couple of them weren't too bad. The other ones were kind of like, you know, the Worlds of Power books, which we will get into here. They are of varying quality, but you know what? They have, some of them have some lasting legacy going on. And, you know, it was the best we could do at the time. As you said, we were kids, not to mention Japan and North America and the Western market in general were like miles and miles apart. You did not get much in the way of, you know, the supplementary story materials and whatnot that Japan got over there. So you had Western people doing their best with what they had. And in the case of Worlds of Power, that was basically invented or thought up of by, the pseudonym is FX9, but the person in charge of everything was Seth Godin, who is an author.com executive, founder of revenue sharing blogging. Remember Squidoo? He founded that.
23 Squidoo.
Did you ever get suckered into writing for Squidoo or any blog like it?
No. I've never Squidooed. I've never been a Squidoo.
Squidoo was actually bought by HubPages, who suckered me into writing for them. And this was at the time, this was the very early days of writing for online. And the things that they tried to do for you back then was exactly what Seth Godin founded here, which is, hey, if you write a story and we put ads on the story, and the ads are going to make zillions of dollars and you get some of that zillions of dollars. Isn't that great? Isn't that a great payment system? In all my years of writing for that, because I didn't really do it for long, to be honest with you. But as long as I did write for them, I think one time I got like $100 over the course of several months for an article I wrote about what to do if your dog gets skunked. Because at the time I was like also doubling as a dog groomer and it was popular enough to get me some money. But that was the best I could do.
Dog skunkings were going through the roof at the time too. For listeners who don't know, dog skunkings were on the rise.
They were worse than shooting.
Yeah, it's all the, yeah.
Actually,
that sounds awful. That sounds ridiculous and exploitive and bad.
Yeah, it was all a thing, that's for sure. But the point is, Godin went ahead and wrote these books because I believe he asked his nephew, "What do you like to read?" And his nephew said, "Nothing. Reading is for stupid twerps or whatever." And so Seth Godin noticed that, okay, my nephew is playing a hell of a lot of Nintendo, so what if we combine the two, which is pretty much how we got Worlds of Power, and we got basically narrations of, I think it's 8 or 9 books, maybe 10 counting the 2 junior books, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it's 10 with the junior, yeah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting origin story because they it comes off both as weird marketing guys, like... Mm-hmm. Like, I'll get you, you know, like the weird way old guys in the early 90s would kind of understand a child's property and then just get handed a post-it note that said, you know, one thing about it. And like, we got to make some money off this, you know, like the same post-it note that had Teenage Mutant Turtles, pizza, skateboarding, and like write a Christmas special. That's all you need to know. And they're like, all right. But it also, it has this altruistic, like getting kids to read because reading at the time was definitely, and even now, seen as like inherently more virtuous. Like, gotta get kids reading. If they read this, they might read other stuff. And hey, that's half, you know, the battle. I think about Seth Godin a lot. I was looking into him before this as a thing, and most of the other stuff that he has is all just like, how do you stand out in marketing? How, like, all this nightmare venture capital stuff. It just looks skeevy to me. But this is something I have a lot of affection for, obviously.
it is interesting to go over these books as an adult and kind of observe that mix of marketing and actual game lore, because there are a couple, like, these books actually weren't all written by Godin. There were several authors involved, yeah. And each one kind of had their own flair. Like, I believe one of the better authors, at least to me, was A.L. Singer, who I wrote down his real name, but I completely forgot it. But that was a pseudonym he wrote under as well. And he did Blaster Master, and we'll get into that in a minute, because Blaster Master, that the book that he wrote, actually became canon in the Blaster Master series. Yeah. That's still used to this day, and it's really funny. And he also wrote Ninja Gaiden, which was one of the better ones. And also, I think he did Bases Loaded, which that was probably the one that really eluded me, because I didn't care about baseball. Did you read that one?
I read all of them for preparation for my thing. Bases Loaded is a pretty tough putt. It is my least favorite of his. I think he's also, because they all use the pseudonym FX9 and you had to kind of look. And so he might have also read written Beyond Shadow, or the Shadowgate one, which is also real good, I think.
Oh, that's by Ellen Miles, actually, who is still active.
Ellen Miles. Yeah. My mistake. That one's real good. Bases Loaded is real weird, because there's not a narrative to a baseball game, and he doesn't talk about the mechanics or anything. So it's just kind of like a goofy kid comedy that has a baseball game as the central premise. Mm-hmm. But I love that it's Bases Loaded 2 is the book. It's not Bases Loaded.
The harrowing sequel.
Out of nowhere, there's a Bases Loaded 2 that's a bunch of new kids playing a baseball game for 70 pages of absolutely large print.
Humongo print.
Yeah, it's that was one of the harder ones to get through, for sure.
Yeah, no, I can see why. But going back to how Godin was a marketing genius as well as kind of a fun guy at heart, I suppose, is the name itself, FX9. Now, why did he choose it? Because it was simply a matter of how bookstores display their books, and kids are going to be looking for Nintendo, N-I-N. Well, there's a last name, 9, N-I-N. Pretty clever, I have to say.
Yeah, and FX as a kid. Like, that sounded awesome. This was the age of American Gladiators. So, right. Like, if somebody was named Nitro, the guy was on board. It's like, this guy knows what's going on.
This guy
I want career advice from. Yeah. Rytro.
Rytro. Rhymes. It must be fate.
He's doing the novel off with a contestant or the challenger. But
everyone just sits and writes.
Yeah. FX was just the coolest name. So it just sounded exceedingly cool to me as a guy. It sounded like it was written by a robot. Chip. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. It's just inherently a cool name.
It's
good,
like Rob the Robot suddenly became useful and started writing these books. There you go.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it is.
In this AI future, nightmare future. We talked about what I think is interesting with this, and I learned this because previous to this, I just wanted to read them because I was just trying to get the style. I hadn't really done backdrop research, so kind of looking into it for the podcast. I always knew that there were no first party Nintendo games in this list. Like, we keep throwing around names, and they're big Nintendo names, but they're not Mario, Zelda, Metroid. And that is because that fell through. He was going to originally do this. There were going to be first party Nintendo games in this, and it didn't happen. So that's interesting. They tried.
Yeah. And I'm surprised. Actually, it sounds like it got pretty far, but something fell through at the last minute. It didn't go through. And that's too bad. It would have been interesting. I wonder if that's when Nintendo later on did the Mario books, because that was around 90, 91. And this was around 86 through 89. So it's actually also surprising how early they came out, because 86, Nintendo still wasn't exactly on fire in North America just yet. It was more like 87 and beyond.
Yeah. I also wonder if Nintendo, it not working out, has anything to do with the Nintendo Power comics and narratives that would come over. I don't know if they're directly related, but in terms of just as a kid niche that was being filled, that was my first exposure to that. Earlier we were talking about, we didn't really get the supplementary materials. So it made Nintendo Power, when they would have, you know, NES, you know, talk to the Zelda, talk to Link, it was just incredible feeling. You know, it's like, oh, this is official.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, they were actually, you're talking about the Nestor Howard comics, right?
Yeah.
They were written really well. Actually, Nintendo's comics, the comics that were in the magazines, like, at the time I thought, oh, these are kind of lame because they're taking up game room. But no, going back, a lot of them are really great. Like, the Star Fox comic is quite good.
Well, they're more useful, I guess. They stand up more than walkthroughs of Star Fox. You know, a Star Fox comic is a more unique thing than a walkthrough of Star Fox now.
Yeah. And actually, the Worlds of Power books kind of doubled as quote unquote tip books. I can't remember if these are like the books where you held them up to a mirror and it's like, ooh, you solved the code. And it said something stupid like there's a secret passage at Yuba Lake in Castlevania 2. It's like, that tells me nothing. That tells me absolutely nothing. Like you have to kneel to find it. But
they weren't super useful.
No.
It's somewhere between a Castlevania 2 NPC and a pro tip. You know,
exactly.
The idea, I think the intended rhythm was you would read a chapter and then take that tip and play the game. But that also felt insane to me. Like the idea of keeping that book there and just flipping to the end of every chapter to read the hint or having it as a reference didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was part of the general vibe of like, oh, I'm kind of playing a game.
Yeah, that's actually interesting when you put it like that. It kind of reminds me of the, what's it called? The Fighting Dungeon books where you'd roll the dice.
Fighting Fantasy.
That's it. Yeah. Death Trap Dungeon,
that's
what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
The Metro or the Mario games you're talking about, those ones, there's a bunch of them that are, I don't know which ones you had, the straight up Choose Your Own Adventure ones or the game books. There were ones where you had to solve little puzzles.
Yes, those are the ones I had.
Yeah. Which were more like a different kind of game book. Like you didn't have stats. Like a lot of game books are trying basically to be single player D&D. This is somewhere on that spectrum where there's a little bit of interactivity with these hints. But it's at the far, far, far end of the spectrum, like a little bit of a gimmick.
Yeah. And of course, it's a choose your own adventure book. So I'm going to be flipping to, oh no, Luigi died. Everything. Okay, I'm going back.
Actually, that's just canon.
Luigi died.
It's very fun to play choose your own adventure games with permadeath or Iron Man mode, where when you die, that's just the story. Like your kid found a briefcase of $1 million, then fell off a cliff. Oh. The end. Ernest Hemingway, eat your heart out. Yeah.
Were you into like regular Choose Your Own Adventure as a kid?
Oh, yeah, still am. I have a pretty big collection of Choose Your Own Adventures and Weird Also Rans. I used to do, for a little while, I did a series of permadeath Choose Your Own Adventure readings called Choose Your Illusion 2.
I love that. Thank you.
Where I do that, and I found all kinds of weird ones. So I had lots of game books, like Death Trap Dungeon, Fighting Fantasy, and the Lone Wolf, and then weird ones. They made one, I can't remember the name because I don't have it right in front of me, but where you would get to the chapter end where you'd make your choice, and it gave you code to put into QBasic.
Oh,
to
really?
See where you're supposed to go. Like you had to write a little program at the end, which is real neat. Like there's a whole world of Weird Also Ran Choose Your Own Adventures.
That is so cool. Yeah, I knew about the Also Rans, but I mostly stuck to Choose Your Own Adventures. I was actually rereading one that was particularly brilliant, I have to say, and that was, was it Inside UFO 5440 or something like that?
Yeah.
And that was the one. The thing that made that unique is that you were kidnapped and you were put on a UFO that was going to some planet where you're going to be in a zoo, but the ship was also trying to make a detour to a place called Elysium or some paradise. Utopia, that was it. And there's no legit way to find Utopia. You have to basically cheat and flip through the book until you find the real ending. And to this day, people talk about that. Like, oh, that's not fair. Yes, it is. It's teaching you how to think outside the box. But it's actually not just a great book because it has that unique ending, but also because it's just written extremely well for a kid's book. You can always tell when a kid's book is written really well. Like, it doesn't talk down to them, but it's still like, hey, kids, this is cool science. And some of the deaths were like really grisly, which I always like. I always like the Choose Your Own Adventures with grisly deaths.
It's phenomenal. I love things that break that format. There's a really, this is as tangential as it gets, but there's a Goosebumps series of Choose Your Own Adventure books. And in one of them, you get trapped in a time loop that each page just refers back to the other page.
That's terrifying.
Like one of the endings, and just like turn to page 4. And then when you read that, it says turn to page 56, which then says turn to page 4. And you're just doomed. And that's the story of your character going through like being stuck. It's real neat.
Sorry, kid.
There's a lot of cool things you do that format. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. A book that softlocks you is a beautiful creepypasta or Black Mirror episode.
Oh, that would be amazing. There you go, kids. It's a free idea. But going to the books themselves, we have, again, about 10 of them. Just going down the list, we have Blaster Master by A.L. Singer, Metal Gear by Alexander Frost. Ninja Gaiden by A.L. Singer, Castlevania 2 by Christopher Howell, Witches and Warriors by Alan Miles, Bionic Commando by Judith Bowell Stamper, Infiltrator by A.L. Singer, Before Shadowgate by Alan Miles, Mega Man 2 by Alan Miles, that's one of the junior books, and Bases Loaded, which we talked about, which is also another junior book. You read all of these. Do any of them really stand out as your favorite?
Before Shadowgate's my favorite of them, and it's for Weasley reasons, which is that it's not, it's a prequel, you know, obviously with the before. So it kind of just reads as a YA fantasy book, like early, you know, 90s YA, not current YA. Yeah, like young reader fantasy book that has some references to things I loved from Shadowgate, but not tons. Cool. And it was neat because Shadowgate is a game where like there's not a whole lot of story on display. You know, you don't get a lot of that background. You get a cutscene in the beginning and the end, and that's all of the text. Everything else is just puzzles and atmosphere. So it was giving me background I did not have another way to get, you know, regardless of how non-canonical it was. I didn't have a way to get this background. Like, I didn't have the internet. I couldn't go to my local library and, like, read about Shadowgate. This is a way to get more Shadowgate. And then when I reread them as an adult... I didn't have them all as children, but it's one of the ones I had as children. Well, I reread it as an adult. Who knows how much of this was nostalgia, but it held up better than the rest of them. It's a real breezy, fun, like, children's book.
Yeah, that's cool. I like they actually went the prequel route with that instead of trying to make a game out of baseball for something.
Yeah. or just Shadowgate and just like constantly worrying about how many torches you have you're walking around. Like, yeah.
Because they kind of described, I think, Solid Snake as a walking arsenal. And you just picture him like with handfuls of these guns dripping out of his arms as he goes down the hallway. But he wasn't allowed to use any of them, of course. He weren't allowed to shoot anything.
It was so funny because that was a big part of the Metal Gear appeal as a kid. Like, my favorite video game advertisement of all time is the Metal Gear NES advertisement with just
that's,
the item.
That's my husband's favorite, too. Yeah.
Yeah. I that was so enticing to me and just fired my imagination so much. And then I got the book and he has a lot, it kind of makes him more MacGyver-y. So it's kind of fun. He solves problems in other ways other than shooting, but it does end up becoming ridiculous. His commitment to non-lethal run of,
Yeah. And there's a anti-smoking PSA in there, as I remember as well.
Yeah, which is good because kids shouldn't smoke.
Kids shouldn't smoke, no. But in the '80s, it was kind of different.
There's kind of so like when you read all these together, there's kind of three types I found. There's adaptations, where it tells the story of it, maybe expand it, but tells the story. There's ones that have nothing to do with it, so either like prequels or Bases Loaded, which has no story, and then there's like isekais. There's one for a little kid. A kid comes in and bounces off of the character. Those have some charm as an adult too. The Castlevania 2 one has that, and it's pretty fun. Like, just thinking about this, big beef golem walking around, mega himbo, and then just like a kid just being like, I don't know, Simon. Like, it's kind of cute.
it is now, but like going back to when I was a kid, or even when I was even like out in my 20s, was like, I don't like this. I don't like this stupid kid. Back then, there was no term for isekai, so we had no term.
Yeah,
I was just like, oh God, it's a Saturday morning cartoon. It's like, remember the Darkstalkers cartoon, and you couldn't have the cool monsters. You had to have some bratty ass kid in there ruining everything. So I hated it when shows and books and whatnot put kids. It's like, I don't want to read about you. I know I'm lame. I know I'm a stupid kid. I want to read the cool Simon Belmont and Kuros from Wizards and Warriors. I think Wizards and Warriors was another isekai one, wasn't it?
Yeah. That's one where a kid comes in. Well, it was also, for me, one of the contrasts was when the books were unexpectedly a comedy book, I was very surprised because the games are really serious, which in retrospect seems really quaint, right? To like play Wizards and Warriors and be like, this is life and death. This is the coolest thing, but that's the power of kid imagination. So the idea of having there be like jokes in it and have it be kind of slapsticky felt really strange. Like, all the jokes in Castlevania 2, even though they make it kind of charming now, at the time I was like, this isn't Castlevania 2. Castlevania 2 is terrifying. Night could happen at any time. You're in so much danger. And in the book, it's just jokes.
Yeah. I remember Simon being kind of bumbling and the kid being stupid. And it was, as you say, Castlevania 2 was kind of a terrifying game. Castlevania 2 was probably my first major Castlevania game that I really, really, really got into. And, I have written articles about this, and so has Parrish. I probably crib them off him actually, where the closer you get to Dracula, the more dead and more like, disturbing things become. Like, right before Dracula, you have that town full of people. They're just gone. All the life is gone.
I love that empty town so much.
Graveyards. Yeah. God. And the one town has that one person who's like, let's live here together. I'm out of here.
Here together forever or whatever. Yeah. You're in good company of Castlevania 2 likers. I'm with you.
I actually got to interview Koji Igarashi a few years back before the plague. And I talked to him about Castlevania 2 and its ties into Symphony of the Night. Because this was actually my husband's question. It was a good question. I asked him, like, did Castlevania 2 inspire Symphony of the Night at all? And he said, yes, actually, it was Castlevania 2 that convinced Konami, okay, you can go ahead and do another adventure game, obviously, that works for Castlevania, so do what you can. And he did, and that's how we got Symphony of the Night, which is one of my favorite games of all time.
Yeah, phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. That was a cool answer.
You're talking about that kind of censorship. It's most obvious in the Metal Gear game, but it's in the other ones as well, like in a plausibly deniable way. You know, like we don't actually know what happens to a bat when Simon Belmont whips it.
That's
it kind of disappears and turns into currency. That's a whole abstract process.
and then here, for you.
There are no ethical bat slaughters, but this just knocks them out. It has to give it text, you know, and it works other than Metal Gear, where it's like that was an explicitly more adult and military themed game for the time.
I wouldn't have even minded if, like, he just stopped collecting guns for 5 seconds. I understand Metal Gear is a more stealthy game. He easily could have written a book about him, like, knocking out people. But no, he's got to carry all these guns around that he can't use.
Yeah.
But that actually, I think I liked Metal Gear more than some of the others. I like Bionic Commando. I really like Ninja Gaiden. I think that Ninja Gaiden was pretty good, actually, for a book.
Yeah, Ninja Gaiden's good and Bionic Commando are both pretty good.
Yeah.
But those as definitely top half.
Speaking of censorship, Ninja Gaiden, they did bring back Ryu's father. He's alive, guys.
He's fine. very funny. But that was also the author liked that, writing that one the best. He was like, I can't just get into his head. And it's interesting if you look at the research process that Seth Godin did for these, where they played the games, they didn't have, you know, the same way I didn't have access to background on Shadowgate, they didn't have YouTube walkthroughs they could watch and take notes or anything like that. They just had to play the games.
Oh.
So they would play the games, and he made, I think it's a 40-page Bible for the writers.
Yes.
That would describe the game, the levels, the plot for them to go off of. And that's, again, really admirable, thinking of Seth Godin sitting in a room, you know, trying to get through Metal Gear. So, you know, which is a non-intuitive game, I think.
No, for sure.
You know, just making his way through it to write up this guide, you know. It comes through. And I think the reason I brought that up is Ninja Gaiden, you know, being this narrative focused game with cutscenes and kind of a character voice. I can see what Al Singer means by being able to get in the head of him. Ryu has a personality in a way that, like, I don't know, you know, Mega Man doesn't display in Mega Man 2.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is why they kind of made him a human. That one I do not get. I would actually love to contact Ellen Miles. Maybe I will. And maybe do a follow-up sometime, because right now she's writing something called The Puppy Place, which is one of those book series where animals get into shenanigans as a group, like the warrior cats and whatnot, like that kind of genre.
Oh, yeah.
So apparently it's a hit, which I completely imagine. It's like Babysitter Club with dogs. Like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah.
Even though it's more of a Sweet Valley kid. But I suppose Mega Man 2, she made him a human. I think the plot goes like, oh no, there's an accident, and it turns Mega Man human for some reason. I don't get it. And maybe because it was easier to write someone with emotions by saying, oh, they're human now, and deal with it. I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah, it was kind of, well, and it was also before Captain N and before the Mega Man cartoon.
Right.
You know, so like the idea of Mega Man being having any of his I want to be a real boy stuff wasn't really an angle for it. My favorite thing about the Mega Man book is it's really dutiful to the structure of the game. When he does the rematches in Wily's world, it's just a paragraph with one sentence for each robot. So it's just like he crushed Quick Man. He, you know, smat, like a little alliteration things. He flushed Flash Man down the toilet. He did it's just eight sentences, one for each robot. Like,
yeah.
And that's it, which is, you know, that whole thing is just a victory lap. You know the weaknesses kill these things in three
which,
hits.
Yeah, which Ow. Is like, or it should just say Mega Man took out his metal blade and that was the end of everything.
Yeah, yeah. Mega Man took care of it, John Wick style, and then that's it. It was
really, Mega Wick.
Yeah, Mega Wick. Wick Man. It just felt, it was very funny going back and reading it and being like, well, we're done with that.
No, he took care of business pretty quickly. Oh, yeah, so the Mega Man 2 one, also want to mention how the cover is another instance of censorship. Basically, anytime there's a gun or a knife, it's off the cover. FX9 was basically, these books just took the box cover and said, here's your cover for the book, which is pretty brilliant, like, obviously, for obvious reasons. But even Mega Man 2, which has, like, a really lame-ass box art, I mean, it's cool in retrospect. And you're like, oh, man, I love this style because I'm old and I think that's just really original. But back then, it looked really lame. Mega Man had a lame-ass gun and he's shooting it at Quick Man, so of course the gun's gone, so it looks like Mega Man's trying to punch Quick Man, which is like, good luck.
We're playing rock paper scissors with punching. Him
yeah,
like he's just holding out a fist. It'd be like if you're playing rock paper scissors and the way you did it was holding out your fist and just taking on all comers.
Yeah,
you know, it's, anybody it's
rock
who
man.
Wants it yeah just take me on
can do.
Yeah, and then just a fleet of paper men come and take you out.
Oh, that'd make him feel special, though. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
But that was one of the funnier instances of censorship. The one instance of censorship I think is my favorite is taking away Ryu's dagger in the Ninja Gaiden. So it looks like he's knocking on a door. I think Solid Sharky once called it Knock Knock Ninja Pizza Delivery, and I never forgot that.
The Solid Snake one is very funny, too, where he just doesn't have anything in his hand.
Oh, he looks like he's jerking he's just off. Holding, yeah, that's pretty great.
Yeah, like, hold it, like, yeah, or holding some kind of weird ghost baby.
You know, Death Stranding.
There's a boss fight. Yeah, it's the lineage is complete. There's a boss fight in Dark Souls 3 where a character carries an invisible baby, and it always reminds me of that. They end up patching out.
That's
because
right.
At some point he like tucks it down and steps on it, and they didn't want to show that.
Of course,
the cowards.
Of course, that sounds like Microsoft.
Yeah,
no, that's pretty.
But
great.
even down to real penny ante stuff, like the Shadowgate one has the horns off of the gargoyle, as if kids would read that and grow horns.
Yeah, and the tail of the demon that's breaking out of the cement, that's like rounded, so yeah. It's more of a spade than a point.
This one's cool.
I don't know what difference. Like it's still glowing. Yeah. Its eyes are still glowing.
It doesn't not look scary. It's just it's less of a sharp object if you had a toy of it. Like if you stepped on this cover, it would hurt you less.
I think it was basically, satanic panic. So, oh no, can't let the kids see a demon. Mom's not going to buy this, which is, I'm not wrong. And I think they took references to demons out of the Shadowgate prequel, but you would know better than I would.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty gentle. Again, it's him. There's not as many demons because it's the character in like civilization for portions of it. The things you see at the beginning and end where you talk to the king, like there are parts where you're in, you know, there are people. You know, it's a populated world as opposed to a big lonely dungeon full of monsters and trolls and stuff.
That's cool. It was always cool to see how the writers used their imagination for these games, because even though they weren't always the best, you could tell they cared. Going back to the writing is solid. Like, these are obviously professional writers who already know what they're doing. And even though they're kind of filling in the blanks and you can tell where they don't really know what else to do, like, I mean, I think that's how we ended up with the isekai stuff in the first place. They're still fun to look back on. It's not like, ew, this is gross, I can't stand this. No, it's cool. Like looking back at like any young adult book from the time, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. They're competent. You know, it's reading them now. You know, I'm a 42-year-old man. Reading a book for like 9-year-olds.
42 as well.
Yeah, feels a little weird. I'm just kind of like, oh, this is a little bit boring and slow-paced and toothless. Oh, wait, I'm old and this isn't for me. Like that. That's why.
Yeah.
You know, but in terms of children's books, like not only are they not embarrassing to read now, even at the time, like I remember them feeling pretty good. Like I had read worse books as a kid.
Yeah.
There were entries in the Boxcar Children that I thought
such
were
such a boring ass
these.
Series.
Yeah.
Oh my God,
what if someone housed children? The series, they were not great. And these were better written, more exciting, you know, by virtue of the subject matter, right? Like it was about cool action-y stuff. It's the same way when I got into, you know, middle school and read The Hobbit because I had swords in it. You know, there was kind of a subject matter kind of thing that elevated something and made it feel a little bit more exciting at the time. So in that way, you know, you talk about him taking the NES covers as a marketing thing, if the goal was to get people who were not as interested in reading, getting into reading, it did everything right. Like that, that cover thing worked for me. The pacing and just, there is a Mega Man here. You know, what are the advantages of this over Maniac McGee? Well, Mega Man's in it. Mega Man doesn't show up until the post-credits scene of Maniac McGee. Blast the sandwich out of that kid's hand. You know, stay golden, Pony Man.
Stay golden, Mega Man.
Yeah, it was just, it absolutely worked. They're pretty well written.
They are. And to their credit, there's not anything really super insidious here. It's not like, oh, we wrote these so you will buy the games, though I'm sure that still had some, you know, Nintendo or whoever, the third parties didn't object to that. But it was Golden write it to get his kids and his nephew to read. And as he said, it did everything right. Very easy reads. They go down easy. Again, the subject matter could be a little bit silly. But then again, there's 10 books. And as I said, they're written in like several styles. So I think a kid would be able to find a style that suits them. Maybe they do want something funnier. Maybe they do want something more serious. I mean, either way, you're not getting a gun. So deal with that. Yeah. But yeah, there are definitely tones here. And maybe even Shadowgate would be a little bit more suited for a little bit of an older reader, whereas we already have these junior books. So they really did run the gamut here. And I really wish they actually would have done more, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's imagining a world where this was a whole ecosystem is real fun, you know, and imagining, which is part of like why I did the project that I did with them, was the idea of thinking of these for other games. And then they kind of became general comedy books, you know, aside from that, because it's hard to write a children's book that's just a straight putt that would be like a children's book, you know,
I actually tried to, there was a challenge I took way back on the parish's message boards, talking time, where someone said, hey, write just a paragraph or a chapter in the style of one of those books from that era. And so I chose something, I think it was Mario 64, and just writing about how Mario hoped the princess would make lots of spaghetti, and he's licking his lips and rubbing his stomach. And it's like, I feel so stupid writing this. I can't stand this. Yeah. I'm going to go write some more werewolf porn. Move.
It reminds me a little bit of when Mario Maker comes out and everyone tries to make a 1-1. Like everyone tried to make a beginning level. And the difficulty of doing something that is a simple introduction. Yeah. It's the same thing with like music, like pop, like a really, really good pop song is also hard to write. Like there's doing the basics can be very difficult.
No, for sure. And actually, before we move on, I want to shout out to, first of all, I want to shout out the article that I sourced for most of this, which was called 8-Bit Lit. And that was all about basically, I think that was by Sean Strzok, who's a dude I know, and he's cool. And he put a lot of research into this. I think Scott Sharpke helped as well. He talked to Godin about why he wrote this and what he wrote and what he did and how he went through all. This is basically the source you have for this series of books and how it happened. But of course, this is the internet, and the article is long gone. Thankfully, it's been preserved on archive.org. But there's one quote I want to read here about Bionic Commando. While Bionic Commando does not follow the NES game's climax with the enemy leader fatally double-crossed by a clone of Hitler, the hero's complete lack of sympathy for an evil man being eliminated by an even evil more man is clearly noted. So Hitler's head exploded. Okay.
Yeah, it's actually very in the times with current things where he doesn't have sympathy because he's a bad man and he declares it, so it doesn't confuse any readers.
Oh, of course.
Or be like, I can't believe this is endorsing a serial killer. It has one. You know, it's very modern discourse.
Don't worry, kids. He got blown up real good.
Yeah, he's gone. You mentioned this earlier. Like, I think an interesting thing about this, which I ended up finding out about when I was reading these, is the bit of how Blaster Master shows up.
Yes.
In the real Blaster Master games, like if you're a Blaster Master head, the book has characters that are in the book are in the games now.
They are. Uh-huh. And they started, I think what happened was in 2000, Blaster Master Recharge or whatever it was called, Blaster Master Blasting Again. That's it for the PlayStation. The
funniest title. It's so That's tired.
Yeah.
Still blasting.
Blasting again.
Still blasting all after all these years.
Electric Boogaloo.
It was Blasting Master.
But that book had Eve, who I don't I know I read the Blaster Master book, but I couldn't find it when I was trying to reread this stuff. She was basically just an underground alien or something, or she was some kind of fake. And they wrote her into blasting again, where she had two kids with Jason, Elfie and Roddy, which was why would you name your kid Roddy? Don't do that.
Incredible. Yeah. It's a pretty, it's a namespace that's been taken up.
Yeah.
Strong associations. Yeah. She's like a fake alien. Like she's basically human and fooled him, if I recall. And then the reveal was she was an alien and then they fell in love. Like I love thinking about that in the canon and thinking about the story of that and imagining the person who's like, I really love Blaster Master, but like, did he ever find love? You know, did that kid ever like procreate? I gotta know, you know, based on playing Blaster. Did he ever know the joys of fatherhood?
Are the questions. These are the questions.
Keep us up at night, you know?
Idea
of that rolling in, that's the story I want to know is like, did the devs behind that read this? And then, you know, like, I guess they were fans, right?
I think
somebody
they were.
Had to have been. Yeah. That's interesting. That's fascinating.
Was the Blaster Master one of the ones by, that was by A.L. Singer, I believe. Apparently, as far as I know, and as far as he knows from what I read, this was an instance of Japan looking at something America had done, saying, hey, cool, let's make this game out of this. Let's pay tribute to this source that from the West. And A.L. Singer says he was very, like, just touched that actually happened. And Inja Creates, who makes the Mega Man Zero series and Gunvolt Chronicles and a whole bunch of pretty great platformers, also does Blaster Master Zero. There's three games there. It gets really weird with the whole reproduction thing and Elfie and Roddy and what they are and who they are. But I couldn't even follow it, to be honest with you. But Inja Creates, when they see a robot girl, they never met a robot girl they didn't like. So, you know, there's something weird going on there. And I think, actually, she is part now part of the larger Inja Creates universe, which is sprawling at this point, I suppose. I haven't really kept up since Zero, so I'm a little bit out of the loop. But, yeah, I think that's pretty cool. I think that is really cool, that little bit, that tiny sliver of lore has survived through the 80s, 90s, and beyond. That's pretty cool.
It's the biggest piece of legacy that they have, and it's also it makes – I don't know the story of the Japanese developers coming upon that, but – these were successful, you know, as books, but they weren't like, it's hard to describe the scale exactly. Like they weren't like a sensation. So it makes me wonder if, you know, even at the time they're a little bit niche, there were tons of young reader books at the time. It makes me wonder if the Japanese developers who found this and read it and became fans of it, what they thought its reputation was in America. Like whether they thought adding Eve to this would be a selling point, or if they just thought, no, that's a cool plot idea. Like we should have added an extra character for Jason to interact with other than, the frog.
Other than the frog. Yeah. And of course, Blaster Master itself is kind of a localization of a little bit of a different Japanese game by Sunsoft that just has more of an adult tone to it. Whereas in Blaster Master for us, it was a little bit more kid friendly. Like Jason was chasing his lost frog down the hole. Whereas in Japan, it was a whole, like, I don't know.
It's 401k.
Yeah.
it's his life insurance policy.
Yeah, I get that.
And he's only got 10 days to live. So he's got to get that before it falls in a pit. Yeah.
My wife will kill me.
Who will provide with my family? Who will provide with my alien family?
That got dark, but hilarious at the same time. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your own personal foray into making Worlds of Power books and how, as you have already kind of stated, that must have been a challenge in many, many interesting ways.
Yeah. So in the early 2010s to mid 2010s, I wrote two books in a series called Power Worlds. And the idea behind these was to write a Worlds of Power book based on more modern games that are very important to me now. You know, as opposed to things that are important to me as a kid. So, you know, I love Mega Man 2, one of my all-time favorite games. Loved it as a kid, but I grown, involved, and changed my taste. And at the time, one of the podcasts we do on our network is called Bonfireside Chat. About the Dark Souls. Yeah, that's us. That's me. The Dark Souls. Hello. Yeah, me and Cole. No Cole erasure intended. Those games are very important to me. So I was like, what if Dark Souls existed at that time? You know, and it had this kind of cross media stuff. And that kind of spiraled out in my head, and I couldn't get out of my head. I was like, what would Dark Souls look like for NES? If the answer isn't just Legend of Zelda 1, right? I was trying to imagine, like, what would the mechanics be? What would be? So I wrote a book that is a short comedy book. It's not really a children's book. It has all of the same markers. So it looks like a Worlds of Power book, has the trading card, has the tips at the end, all of that stuff. But it is written as if it is based on a fictional Dark Souls that came out on the NES, which is real silly and convoluted. And then that was, you know, really cool. I'm really proud of that book. It was part of the ARG to reveal Frog Fractions 2.
Right. That's right.
Which was a big thing. My friend Jim involved me in that, which is really cool. And yeah, it's mostly, it is like a kid's book, and then also just has a bunch of meta and absurd, you know, jokes that I would make ordinarily. When I was doing that, when I Kickstarted that, I bought all of these books and read them all. And my goal was always to do a few of them. I've only done two, and I may do another one at some point, but that one was the Isekai one. So in Souls of Darkness, a character gets sucked into the world of Souls of Darkness and meets a group of companions. It's really Labyrinth inspired. That was my favorite children's movie. The idea of her having a coterie of weirdos who guide her through this world. I had my character do that. And then a couple years later, I did one called Atomic, which is for Fallout. And that is not an isekai. That's in the world and kind of takes the story of it. The most fun part of it was trying to imagine what the NES versions of these would be like. And I did Kickstarter, so I had a bunch of extra things. So I made like a little NES manual for them, or a little comic you would get in a box of cereal that explained like side story stuff. I made a bunch of world building things because the initial idea was, again, what if this idea had continued? What if there weren't 10 of these? What if this continued? There's always a place in the world for these little, like dime store paperbacks about video games, you know?
I also love the art that you have, like a Konami style art, box arts going on for the Dark Souls one, don't you?
Yeah. That's very specifically. So Nick Daniels, who does some covers for Retronauts, is the artist on those books. And I gave him references for covers, for NES covers, and he just took it and ran with it. Did great. Wonderful work. Yeah, that cover is incredible. And Castlevania was the closest thing in tone for that. So we based that one on Castlevania. The one for Atomic is based on a more obscure game that I'm having a hard time remembering right this second. Coffee hasn't been in the
book. Because you're on the spot.
Yeah, he did great work.
No, he's just great. Yeah, he's done a few covers for my own episodes, and they're pretty great. But for Dark Souls, like, that's a very kind of a lonely game, a lonely dark game. And you have, not only is it an isekai, you have, as you said, the kind of the Labyrinth crew around you. Like, what was the name of the little dog? Fizzwit or something like that.
There's a bone that follows her around called Femur. And so the dog that I know,
it's a bone.
Free floating.
I like bone, that.
That hangs out. And Lounging Carl, the zombie stuff. But it had to be not lonely, you know, because that'd be weird. Dark Souls is a very hard thing to adapt, and nobody's done it well. Like we talked about on our podcast, and there's a whole bunch of comics and stuff, and they're varying degrees of not very good, you know? So I was kind of trying to do that in the flavor of like not really adapting, just kind of like inspired by, you know.
It's actually funny that you made that choice, because what you said about Dark Souls being adapted, because I think there is an official Elden Ring comic that just takes the piss out of the whole thing.
It's a comedy,
great
approach. Yeah, that we get asked a lot, you know, on the podcast, like, how would you adapt this, or like, what do you want to see? And we talk about it, and that's an angle I never considered, but is brilliant. Like, I really want to read that, because not taking it seriously is probably the best thing you could do. You're never going to translate the feeling in the hands of playing, you know, in a passive media. And this actual, like, so much of the Dark Souls feeling is from interactivity. You eliminate that interactivity. It's not, so taking that and just being like, oh, we're just going to come up with a different angle. Brilliant. I haven't read that yet, but I'm sure there's a translation out there.
Oh, there is. I read it myself. I think it came out the day of the comic, but you're right. FromSoft for My Money is like the king of world building. And I've said this many times on Axe of the Blood God, where I don't play all the FromSoft games. I absolutely adored Elden Ring and I liked Bloodborne a lot, but I kind of bounced a little bit off Dark Souls. It's just not my jam. But even that being the case, I do read lore about the world, but also particularly in a game like Bloodborne, it's all about how the game weaves the atmosphere by, as you say, interacting with it. And that would be something that would be so hard, as you said, to put on paper. So you just kind of made the right choice, I think, by cutting loose and having fun with it. Because the very concept of like Dark Souls being kind of more of a labyrinth type adventure is fun. It sounds fun. It sounds hilarious. And frankly, probably a little more interesting than reading what would, I mean, if you want something like Dark Souls in book or comic form, go read Berserk. There's your Dark Souls. It exists.
Yeah. And then like Gene Wolfe novels and stuff. Like there are a lot of, there are a lot of fantasy things that kind of get the same tone, but it's not exactly the same. I just wanted to make a bunch of jokes about the different areas of Dark Souls, basically.
Another poison swamp.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you go down to the scunge pit or whatever I call it in that. And just like silly, one of the early, like in Dark Souls, the way they tell their story is through items having descriptions.
You
pick up a shield, it tells you. And in Souls of Darkness in the book, everything has a post-it note on it. So when you pick up a shield, it has a post-it note that explains that. And then you take off the post-it note. Like little things like that, that are just, it wouldn't be what they would do in an actual Worlds of Power. It was just me being goofy.
Yeah. And like, was this, once you started, was it kind of easy for you to find your voice and just, go along? Or do you find yourself hitting roadblocks a lot?
Souls of Darkness, super easy to write. Atomic was very hard to write. It was in 2014. I was real angry because of gamer culture shit. It was, peak Gamergate years, and I was in a stage of political awakening, so I was very cranky. It's an angry book,
for sure.
Which was not necessarily my intent. And I think that's kind of why I haven't done one since, is it was, it came out sideways, it was difficult.
Right.
The character also, like, because I wanted to write about, kind of a shitty white guy who figures out, I wanted to talk about like privilege and stuff, because that was in the air in a way that was still through this without being preachy. So the character's head was not as fun to be in, because he was not, he gets okay, but he starts off as kind of a shit. Sorry to curse quite so much. I know that's okay on here, but the other one is a lot significantly easier. Maya Hunter is a lot more fun of a character to be in the head of. So kind of both.
If you did get the opportunity to do another one, like, do you have any idea what you do? Any dreams? Any sketches?
In the beginning of it, I said I have a fake, like, you may also like these other books in the series. And they're just all the games that are in my, like, huge, my canon, like my all-time favorite games.
Oh, beauty.
I would love to do Bloodborne.
That'd be great. Yes.
And the only thing I have in the idea for it right now is that in Bloodborne, everyone wants to get more eyes, like you had eyes on the inside and stuff, and I just think that if you do that and everyone just got bigger eyes until the actual deacons of the church or whatever are walking around with a wheelbarrow with their two like distended eyes in it, and they're just like, man, that guy's smart, like, you look at that, that's the wisest person I've ever seen, and it's just somebody trundling both their eyeballs literally the only thing I have prepared for it. So
That would definitely not be one of the ones for the kids.
No. And it just the same thing happened, like when you do passion projects like that. Like, I'm very lucky, like I do podcasts for my full time job now.
Great.
So it takes up most of my time.
Yeah. No, I get that. Cause I myself am working on a couple of books and I'm also podcasting full time pretty much. And yeah, it can be difficult to juggle it all, but that is why I stay up till 3 a.m. cause that is my power hour, I suppose. But I would love to try my hand at something like this. But as I said, it is harder to write than you would think it would be. And I don't know what I would do. You know what? I actually co-wrote the Mega Man X Maverick Hunter Field Guide by Udon with my husband, nice. David Oxford. And that was a lot of fun because we presented it kind of in the style of narrative versus a actual guidebook. Like, this is what you would be handed if you were, you know, starting out at Maverick Hunter headquarters. These are the characters, these are the items, these are the armors. Yes, about the world.
That's the best. I love that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So I had, like, I used to write a lot of Mega Man fan fiction when I was younger. That's more or less how I got my start with writing. And so I had a great time just going back and writing about all these characters I used to write about when I was young. And so I think I would love to try my hand at something like this, but of course it's just like, well, put it on the pile of projects I have going, I suppose, because maybe when I'm 70, I'll get around to it.
Hugely time consuming, like writing books. And with that guide thing, you have to do layout and stuff as well. I'm always very impressed by, I feel like we've been talking sugar about Jeremy constantly on this podcast. But I'm always very impressed by how many books he puts out, because the layout stuff does not come natural to me. So it's and he's just very prolific. And then very time consuming.
I don't think he sleeps
brick by brick. Yeah. Just loves doing projects. It's awesome. It's cool as a fan too.
No, for sure. Like, he does. He definitely a big inspiration. That's why I'm working on my own books as well. And this whole Worlds of Power thing is very much a big part of fandom and fan fiction culture, which is something I am spoiler writing about. Something I've always been interested in because, as I said, I am a fanfic writer and I was a fanfic writer. So I'm always interested in topics like this where, yes, here is a series of books that was explicitly meant to get kids to read. And even then, when I was a kid and we had the book fairs and, you know, good old Scholastic book fairs and whatnot, you'd still had teachers, and I'm not talking shit about teachers, they got enough problems, but that you did have the teachers who would try to gatekeep. Like, I had a teacher who was like, oh, you can't buy Ninja Turtle books because, you know, Ninja Turtles are bad. And stuff like that was never fair or fun to me. So I did get kind of a little bit of pushback for buying like the Nintendo books when I was a kid because, oh, it's not real books, which it is. It's real writing. It's good writing, actually, for a kid, like I said.
All reading is reading. Like, I hate gatekeeping around that stuff. I remember, first of all, like, one, in the grand scheme of time, how quaint and silly is it that teacher tried to stop you from reading that book? Because what would Ninja Turtles have done to you? Like, you're fine, you know, and it's talk about fighting the tide, right? Like, it's not like you can limit a child's exposure to Ninja Turtles. In the 90s, like, they were everywhere. But the other thing is just, like, reading is reading. Like, if it's a kid and they're interested in, like, one thing I think about a lot of my childhood and people of our generation is that, like, I really wish that more space was allowed for following interest, because as a kid, I had so many interests that actually, like, did pay off to my career eventually.
Same.
I just wasn't encouraged in any of them. It was always, you know, I remember trying to submit, we were doing a book report and I wanted to do one of the Lone Wolf, like, game books, not a traditional book report, but I feel like a better teacher would have been like, hey, that's really cool. What's neat about this? Like, this is a vocation. This is a skill. You're obviously showing an interest in this instead of just being shot down, you know, similar to that Ninja Turtle thing. That stuff drives me nuts. It's infuriating.
Yeah. I mean, even growing up, luckily my parents weren't like that. They were always very big readers. We had a lot of comic books around, and that's how I learned to read, because the association of words and pictures, the only problem maybe being is that, okay, I read Archie, which was great, but I also read Mad Magazine, which when you're 3 years old will probably warp your mind. And it did.
Yeah, three is young for Mad.
Yeah. But it was pretty great. I remember looking at these books as, like, young as four and being like, wow, that's funny. So that was a problem.
And you turned out great.
I turned out A-way.
Yeah. You turned out how you turned out, you know?
Exactly.
It is a real, real silly thing to fight a kid's interest like that.
One other kind of interesting quirk is that I grew up with a lot of Beano comics because I have, like, a lot of Irish relatives who sent over stuff from overseas. So I kind of also grew up with this weird Britishness to my writing from, like, I mean, I'm not even talking about, like, classy British. I'm talking about, like, the real gutter British, like, you know, the kids wearing hockey jerseys. Not hockey jerseys, Jesus Christ. Kids wearing, like, rugby jerseys and football jerseys and beating each other up. Dennis the Menace, UK. Oh, man, that kid will kill you before you can kill you in your sleep. So watch yourself, kids.
I love how there's an American Dennis the Menace who, like, every once in a while will take a pie off a windowsill.
Yeah.
And there's a British Dennis the Menace.
The British Dennis the Menace is teaching Nasher how to do dog fighting. That's what he is.
Just like there's a Peaky Blinders Dennis the Menace who will cut your Achilles tendon so you can't run.
Sorry, Britain. Except not. So I guess we should wrap this up because our hour is pretty much up. But I think we had a really, really great time with this, and I hope you enjoyed your time talking about these books. Did you want to wrap up with any final thoughts?
No, just if I were a better salesman, this is where I would say you can buy my books. Souls of Darkness is sold out. I haven't had enough demand to do a reprint because I just printed an amount. So I have like 10 of them in my apartment, and I want to keep one or two, and then the rest of them I've donated a couple to like charity auction things.
Oh, that's nice.
But I'm just keeping them. I have several copies of Atomic. It turns out that Dark Souls is a more popular game and setting, I think. More in the zeitgeist. But if you want to check those out, you can go to duckfeed.tv, the website, and you can get them from there. You can also check out us. We're a whole podcast network. Listeners of Retronauts, probably most interested in our show, Watch Out for Fireballs. Me and Cole have both been on several episodes, and vice versa. Several Retronauts have been on our episodes. It is a Games Club podcast. Started out as a Retro Games Club podcast. Now we've kind of broadened the remit, but we do talk about plenty of old games.
That's really cool. I'm actually really hoping you do that Bloodborne idea someday. That would be a lot of fun.
It'd be really fun. I've been trying to reaccess that part of me that has a big project like that. But it's one of those things when you get a job that is largely maintenance, we put out stuff all the time, but it doesn't feel like we are.
Exactly.
It doesn't feel like, oh hey, I don't have that like birth moment that you get. So it's on the eventual task mask. We will see. We hired somebody for the first time, so some time will slowly start opening up. So
that's cool. Yeah. I mean, as I said, in full-time podcasting, I know that feeling. Mm-hmm. You think you're not working. It's like, oh, how hard can talking in a microphone be? It's a little harder than you think. It wears you out a little faster than you think.
You end up off work and you're like, I don't want to do anything. My executive function is completely taxed. Like spent 4 hours today trying to make up jokes and observations on the spot. What more can I do? It is.
You did okay today. Don't worry about that.
Thank you. They appreciate it. I'm incredibly privileged. It's a great job, absolutely lucky, it is still a job,
No, absolutely. So that's the thing. People don't realize, I've scrubbed toilets for jobs, and I actually think I was probably a little more important then than I am now, but still, a job is a job. It's hard to do. You're on someone's time that is not your own. And
yes.
Yeah. And also I edit as well, and I still do a lot of stuff in the background for gaming, and it's a charmed life, but it is a busy one. And like you, I hope to get to those big projects done because, dear God, like you also, I am in my 40s and there's only so much time I have left on this wretched but beautiful earth. So I'm going to continue to do my best. And I hope you continue to do your best as well.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll do my best. Everyone do the best.
Yeah, there you go. That's a pact. As for me, I'm with the Axe of the Blood God podcast, as well as Retronauts. We cover RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western. We have all kinds of specials and tiers that you can support us on over at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. And of course, need to get booty down to Retronauts at patreon.com/retronauts. And throw some love there too. That way you can get more content like this, which I'm sure you want, because why would you not? And that includes ad-free episodes a week early, as well as several exclusive specials. But until next time, thank you for listening, and happy Nintendo adventuring.